Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredible, vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua. Ah, happy fall, David.
It's not fall yet. It's still, well, it's September.
September 1st.
September 1st.
Labor Day is usually sort of like that hinge where the calendar turns, if you will. But given it's kind of a weird calendar.
It's kind of a weird year.
2020, you know, is just not easy, right? Because technically, we probably, like this Tuesday should be the after Labor Day. That's next Tuesday, right? So, anywho, it's fall to me.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, Labor Day is definitely the last barbecue of summer, right? It's the big send off to the great hibernation.
Yeah. So, I mean, the upside of it is 2020 is closer to ending. However, that's just this naive thought that all of our pain and angst goes away just because it becomes January 1st. We know that's not the truth, but that's a
myth. Are you sure? They keep telling me that once it's January 1st, everything changes.
That's sort of the downside of like blaming 2020. It's like, come on, 2020. And it's like, I didn't want to be that guy in the conversation, but isn't technically every year the start of a new year when you think about it? It's just, we're just opting to, like, you know, I think for tax purposes, picking like a, you know, a date, 2020, but and every moment is a new.
Well, if you ascribe to the Strauss Howe the vision of generational conflict, you know, this 2020 year is sort of around the 80-ish year time of great change and realignment, right? So maybe January 1st, the gods will know that we're past it and everything will be great. It'll be magic, back to some version of maybe not 2019 normal, but maybe just like more status quo. I don't know.
Maybe that is just always the existential question that's always hovering, is like this notion of back to normal, which never will happen again, because to your point, one, do we really want it to go quote unquote back to normal? Maybe it's just back to more predictable, possibly. Yeah. I don't know.
Predictable. Great.
You know, by the way, this is the content that people listen to our podcast for, these existentialist musings on the weather, Strauss Howe, turning of the generations, ..
And also how the loaf of bread is how time is basically a loaf of bread, and that we're in the slice and the loaf at the same time.
Isn't it? Aren't we in the butt of the bread? That one part of the bread that's like, by the way, I like the crust. I love crust. Does this happen in your family where like the end of the loaf, you know, because it's just the top and the butt end of the, like they just, you know, kept shuffling past it and went to the other loaves. Like that's how it was in my family. But then I'm buying in on this. Like I'm going to eat these last two slices and enjoy it, because now I almost have like a calzone. I have like a wheat calzone, you know, or an empanada. It's like a wheat empanada.
Are you serious? Like you actually love the head and the butt of the bread?
I love the head above the loaf. What's wrong with this? Hey, listeners, email us. Let us know. Where are you up on this? Because I think it's a gift. Now I will not eat. I'll not have a sandwich that's just like head and middle slice, you know what I mean? Or like middle slice and butt. It's gotta be head and butt of the bread. Cause then you're forming like a hot pocket or whatever. It's not gonna be hot because whatever's in the middle doesn't, you know what I mean? You get what I'm saying, right? Like you could heat it.
Yeah, but I don't know what kind of bread you buy, but the bread we buy, sometimes the head and the butt are sliced at different thicknesses.
Yeah, lengths, right? Yeah, thicknesses. Yeah,
they don't match.
It's almost good. Like a sliver. It's like a shard. It's not like a full slice.
Or it's like on an angle too. It's really thick at the top and then really thin on the bottom. Like
I love it. I love that part. And listeners, let us know if you're into the butt of the bread or the crust of the bread. This is not like David is. It's not like David just keep passing on.
I skip past the first piece, but I do have the head and the butt sandwich at the end. It's the last sandwich. I don't look forward to it. It just naturally happens at the end.
Because you don't want to waste the bread. You don't want to throw out the bread, Robert.
Correct. You don't want to throw out the bread.
Yeah. I think this is the content people listen for. That being said, thank you, listener, for joining us for another edition of Imagine This Podcast, where as we head, you know, into the cooler months, it's also thinking about policy. Did you see what I did there? Do you like that graceful, graceful thread I wove? But really how, again, in a lot of ways, the ways that we are arranged, the ways we interact with each other are driven by the laws we govern ourselves by. And so that's some of the pieces we'll be reflecting on, at least in the front end of this. But coming up later, we'll be interviewing Jill Anaponicek, who is the artistic director of Milwaukee Opera Theater. She's going to be after the break. Before then, David, you wanted to wonk it up, make us into Pod Save America.
My wife and I have played the Who in our podcast network plays the roles of each of the folks on Pod Save America. That might be another topic for our listeners to weigh in on about who's who.
I'm John Lovett. Right?
He's the snarky. She thinks you're John Lovett too, and it really creeps me out because she has a crush on John Lovett. And she, I don't know how I feel about this, but she also thinks I'm Favreau, which makes me feel a little creepy and creeped out by it. Anyways, so it's September 1st, which means that Congress is coming back into business in D.C. coming off of their
August. Oh, now they're getting to work?
Now they're getting to work. They've been at work. They've been at home. You know, they've been doing their thing. trying to be diplomatic here.
Yeah, anyways, I know you're trying to be diplomatic.
So tonight, y'all may notice that there's been this call for downtown buildings to light themselves up red in awareness of the importance for Congress to pass the Restart Act. The Restart Act is about a $3 trillion package that would help to support our independent venues and other businesses that have been affected by the coronavirus be able to continue to operate. It would refresh and make some technical changes to the PPP loan and a bunch of other things. There's also, Congress is also trying to figure out how to pass a more omnibus sort of fifth phase of the coronavirus recovery legislation. So they've got some work to do in the next few weeks, and it's really, really important for people to reach out to their elected officials, because the federal fiscal year ends at the end of September, which mm-hmm. means that the federal government needs to pass a bill to continue funding, to keep the government open, and also to ensure that all of the small businesses, all of the independent venues, all of the arts and culture organizations, artists, creatives, freelance gig workers have the support they need to continue weathering this COVID-19 storm. And at the same time, as I think some of our listeners who have been following us have known, we've been calling on our state elected officials to pass or to create a arts and culture emergency stability fund. And there's a tranche of money from the CARES Act that still needs to be spent down by the end of the year. And so we have an action on our website that will allow all of our listeners, anybody in Milwaukee or anywhere else, to actually write a letter to their local elected officials about this important issue, our state elected officials, to make sure that they are aware of what's going on. They work across the aisle to create this important stability fund for our state, city, and region's artists and arts organizations, and also to our federal elected officials to make sure that they pass the next round of coronavirus legislation. And this is just so important, because I think as we've been talking about, right, we've been in this coronavirus response now, or recovery time or response time, since March, and with no end in sight.
So the action that our listeners could take, David, is go to imaginemk.org, click on Arts Champion Action Center, and start entering your information, and it'll make sure you get to talk to your, it'll send it to your electeds.
That's right. They can go to our website, exactly where you mentioned, and they can personalize a letter to their elected officials. And not only would we appreciate that action, we would also really appreciate it if you posted it to your social, got it out to your friends and neighbors, because our city and county and regions folks really need to know about what's happening in Madison, D.C., and raise their voice at this time, particularly in these next few weeks, because these next few weeks are going to be really, really important.
Hashtag imaginary friends. We need you to summon the spirit of the BTS army and totally stand it up. This is me translating for a younger audience.
Hey, we should do a TikTok video about this.
Yeah, I think that would totally connect.
You dancing to Megan Thee Stallion, pointing to different links about how we're 50th in the nation in public funding for the arts.
Yeah, I think this, the concept alone's a winner. So I can't, I don't know what we're doing on this radio podcast or whatever, and we should just be doing that right now. But in all seriousness, please take the time to let your electeds know, because the time is now. It's super crucial.
And we will link to all of this in the show notes. So you don't need to copy anything down. Just go to the show notes and take the link to the Action Center.
Awesome. So thanks again, not just for listening, but for taking action. Thanks in advance. Also, we're excited to have an Action soon as our guest for the pod this week, which is a really great opportunity for us to amplify the folks that are doing the work in our network, David. We're bringing on our guest, Jill Anna Ponisik, not just because Jill Anna plays a role as the artistic director at the Milwaukee Operative Theater and has had an incredibly creative life so far, working on multiple productions, as well as collaborating with organizations in town like Skylight Music Theater, Milwaukee Chamber Theater, Present Music, Renaissance Theater Works, the Florentine Opera for Stage, right? List goes on and on. And collaborating. But we got to know Jill Anna through the work of the COVID-19 Task Force, which is centered on looking at small arts and culture organization response to the pandemic. As you know, David, that the pandemic has disrupted arts and culture massively. And for small arts and culture groups, it can be really difficult, given they depend often on performances to generate resources and funds to work, as well as the traditional, you know, methods of applying has been disrupted, right? Because the pandemic has sort of changed the game in terms of sequencing of how resources get out. So we've been convening small arts and culture groups together to not just look at, you know, well, how can small arts and culture groups work across field, work across practice, even work across geography, to work together to be sustainable. But we've also invited them to think about the game differently, right? And so we've conducted several meetings for that. And what's emerged is we've actually had leaders, participants emerge to also co-facilitate this with us and support that. So that's how Jill Anna has shown up, has really been as a peer leader as well. Welcome, Jill Anna.
Well, thank you for having me.
We are so excited to have you on, and sort of not in this context, and not in the context of leading a Zoom meeting, but in a Zoom podcast setting. So thank you for joining us, taking some time out of your day to be with us.
How is this different than a meeting?
We're not sure. In fact, Mac has a couple of times referred to our podcast as a conference call.
on air.
The webinar. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, there's an agenda. We're in boxes.
Yeah. Yes. That's it. We're gonna bring that big Zoom energy to the pod.
I think this is our mental block. We've had a couple of discussions on whether or not we like live stream these. And my mental block has been like, why does anybody want to watch a live stream of a meeting between three people? I don't get it. And maybe it's just I lack the imagination to understand.
I think it's because one of us isn't a TikTok influencer. Like, if one of us got to that status, then like millions of people would watch us unbox like iPhones and whatnot. But not none, unless you are Jill Anna. I don't know.
Our hopes are with you, Jill Anna, that
one. You're the last.
I'm not the experimental opera TikTok thing. Like, hasn't taken off yet, but I'm working on it.
I feel like that's a niche that you should explore.
And I'll get right to that after this podcast.
Awesome. So again, Jill Anna, we've got you on this call. You got a couple of hats. We invited to be on this call. First of all, we'll talk about your role as a leader in the community, namely in role as the artistic director at the Milwaukee Opera Theater. And then we'll later talk about yourself in role in the arts and culture scene here and how we witnessed you in that way. But let's start with how you've come to this work. And so origin story, how have you arrived in your role at the Milwaukee Opera Theater?
Origin story is completely by accident. So I went to school and worked really hard for many years studying music, like always getting in trouble for doing things outside of the music department, like with every teacher at every school in every city that I've lived in telling me that I need to focus. And then I'd be like, oh, but I'm in this theater show and I'm also taking this dance class and I've got a visual art class on 7 on Thursdays and I don't know how to prepare my recital. And so that was just always a thing. And I was bopping around teaching and singing and teaching. And then my husband got a job at the Medical College of Wisconsin in 2009, and we landed here. And I was suddenly looking around for something to do, and Milwaukee's much smaller than the other places that we lived. I started to volunteer with Milwaukee Opera Theater because I needed like some outlet for all of this energy. Mm-hmm. And in the course of volunteering for this tiny organization, there was a production they wanted to do and there really was no money. And like, I actually mean no money, not like the nonprofit speak of, oh, we have no money, but we actually have money. We just want more. Like they had no money. And so there wasn't the ability to hire a director. And so I had no qualifications other than that I was free. So I just stepped in to try and figure out how to direct a show. And thankfully I had like really talented friends I could call and cry to over the phone and who helped coach me through it. And that was a production of the last 5 years. And like 5 minutes into the first rehearsal, I felt this shift inside. And it continued through. And then by the time that the show opened, I was like, oh my God, what have I been doing with my life? This is a much better idea for me. Oh. Like it all of a sudden, in this really quiet but strong way, these things that had been problems like started to align as strengths for me. And the stage fright and anxiety that I had, like on an hourly minute by minute basis as a performer, like just ebbed away when directing, and the focus was on other artists and like helping them excel. And then like the ability to stand in the back and watch a project as a whole and feel the energy in the audience shift, like just allowed me to have this really different sense of what I've made. Whereas like when you are the performer, you kind of have no idea what you're doing because you can't be simultaneously inside and outside of yourself. So like you're just doing your best and you're kind of judging, but you're also being in the moment, but you're kind of judging and it's crazy. Yeah. And in even though directing would seem in some ways to be more stressful because you're doing way more things, you're also like outside of it. And so that just helped me feel like balanced and useful as a human in a way that I don't know that I ever did as just a performer. Or I shouldn't say just a performer because they're everything, but as like using only singing acting.
Do you remember any moments sort of coming up, you know, maybe in your early life where you noticed that, right? Where like you said, like I get, because I'm a big believer in these patterns, right? Then like this wasn't an overnight thing. Like we're like, Do you recall any other times in your life where you sort of noticed like, maybe I'm not that, but it really worked for me here, right?
Well, what's funny is I think I kept running away from it.
Right.
A shy person who eschewed leadership at every turn. So like I was in a gifted and talented program and got like ushered into a leadership like seminar or something in school. And I was like, nope, not for me. And so I think it kind of had to bite me in the butt.
Yeah. Yeah. All these people saw it in you, right? Cause that's how you'd end up in these situations, right? All these people saw it in you. And yet for some reason you would opt differently in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was really just an organization that needed assistance.
Yeah.
And so just in being presented with necessity,
yeah,
it was much easier for me to summon the energy to fulfill that, like to just try and be of help.
Wow. And how long you've been in this role now?
This is my 12th season and it feels like it's been 5 seconds.
Oh, so you sometimes it's like it feels like it's been a century. It hasn't aged
no.
that much. It's that quick.
No, I can't. I can't make heads or tails of it.
What inspires you to be at it for 12 seasons and beyond?
Creativity, helping others, and personal growth tend to be like the three things that get me out of bed. Yeah. Like creativity in really any iteration, helping others achieve their potential. So like in many different ways, but just really a great deal of excitement over that discovery. And then I noticed really early on, I worked in a coffee shop like all through school. Like that's what I did all through school. And I totally loved that I could like make an awesome cappuccino every time, all the time. You know, like I could just be great at it all the time.
Yeah.
And yet I've chosen a vocation for myself where you're bound to fail over and over again. Like, because the goals are always shifting and the world is moving and there's nothing but growth. You know, like you're forced to grow with every project you do because there is no doing the same cappuccino again. Like, you're not. And I think that just made me realize that I need the hunger of that. I have the hunger for like that bigger project. Like what's the next thing I can teach myself how to do? And so that's, I think, the personal growth element.
You know, on that personal growth thing, has there been a lesson that you've constantly maybe failed at? And then recently you were like, okay, now I get it.
So many.
Can you tell me about one?
We can do like 7 podcasts about my
that's
a whole series.
Dave and I are up for like spreading the podcast network. If you think that's a series, we can.
We are all about the backdoor pilot. So
yeah, we are all about the backdoor pilot. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're inspired by Gary Marshall and sort of how he spawned like hundreds of shows like off of Happy Days. Like we're not up. We would copy that. But seriously, what has been a recent lesson where you find yourself, gosh, when will I learn this differently? And then you did.
I think something changed for me in study as a singer. Like it's very focused on sort of perfection and the cultivation of your skills as an individual and a lot of time alone in a practice room and all that stuff. And I think I remember like the first directing projects where it felt like, oh gosh, it's all on me. I better get it right. I hope I can do this. And then this like opening up of, but wait a minute, there are like 18 people sitting in this room right now and they all have brains and imaginations. Uh-huh. And it's not like, I don't have to just like make it work all by myself. I can say that I'm not sure what to do and someone else will probably have an idea and it might be way better than the one that I had. Uh-huh. And I've also learned just by experience that sometimes if I just am willing to say the stupid idea I have, it will spark a brilliant idea in a collaborator. Like that's just something I've learned by trying it.
Yeah.
Like I know that this is not gonna work, this thing that I'm thinking right now, it's not work. But if I just say it out loud, I have a feeling it might lead someone here to like figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
And then it's like more of this coalescing as a team. And then that's like kind of what I super love about theater. Is like watching those different elements start to sink into one thing that they're making together.
That dumb idea thing, I just want to note, David, just before let you in, I just want to notice, I find it that what brings it to life is the ideal outcome. Like that's what you want to bring to life. It just happens to be in a vehicle that's quote unquote dumb, right? So what resonates for me is this notion of like, let me just put it out there just so that you know what the direction is. I'm not attached to the vehicle, but I just want you to know. And in some ways that opens it up because now at least you're operating off of something as opposed to a void.
Yeah, right? Sometimes I'll find myself saying like, this is really stupid, but what if?
Right. I always go like, this is a first draft thought. Or take the best, leave the rest. But how about this?
That's slightly less self-deprecating and I should maybe adopt that practice.
You know, Joanna, sort of sitting here listening to your story, I can't help but sort of reflect a little bit on my journey as a former theater artist and now as an administrator. Coming up in performing arts school, in sort of honing my directorial craft, right? My director's craft, I was always sort of you hit your mark, you say your line, high control, right? High command and control. And it was throughout college that I really, I think, developed a reputation for, you know, the guy who you want to work for, but also you kind of don't want to work for him because he's an asshole, basically.
That's hard to believe.
It wasn't until my developed my senior year project where I went from doing all of these shows that were really tightly scripted, tightly blocked, tightly, you know, put together, to developing a show that was completely improvised from the first day of rehearsal to performance and through the performance. And what that really taught me was that sort of like letting people go and just letting them have the bring their skills and talents, like you just mentioned, to the role, really yielded incredible things that you just couldn't expect. I mean, there were performances that were just terrible. I mean, objectively, really bad theater. But then there were also these performances that were just so unexpected and so beautiful and so magical that what I learned was that, you know, controlling everything to within an inch of its life really sort of squeezed out the genius of others. And I think that that change shifted how I look at leadership in general, right? Which is like, I think Mac can attest to, like, we're relatively not command and control here, right? Like, everybody sort of has brought their own gifts to this organization, and we know what the goal is. We know what we're trying to do together. Now, how do we sort of like break down as many barriers for folks to actually do their work, whether it's the staff on our team or the folks in the network, folks like you in the organization, right? How do we sort of like get people in the right positions to do the best thing that they can in role and in person and in the system?
And it's so exciting when, like, when you do uncover a new pathway, right? That maybe isn't in a textbook.
And also terrifying, yes. Yeah. Because nobody knows the answer, right? Because nobody knows the answer.
So that's how we sort of come to experience you. You know, you lead this organization, Milwaukee Opera Theater. And Imagine MKE is born over the course of 2 years. To come and do its best to galvanize the sector and hopefully arts and culture in the city towards making it more vibrant and inclusive, and that arts and culture has a way. We're born, right? And so now here you are leading an organization, right? Producing work. And now you find yourself coming to these meetings, right? Or you find yourself coming to this conversation, right? Maybe an imaginary professor somewhere going, why don't you stick to your organization? What are you doing, right?
Exactly.
Maybe. But yet instinctually you do it, right? And that's how you come to our attention, is because we recently, as a result of COVID, right, we've been convening different affinities, and one was small arts and culture groups who are really affected by the pandemic and disrupted, both in the ability to do what they do, which is perform, or to produce culture that others can experience in real time, to the sustainability, given all this is disrupted, right? That's a context. And so I'm wondering, sort of just to start a bit, like, what inspired you to come to these meetings, right? Or even share, like, what was your perception of a place like this new organization, like Imagine MKE, right? That, I think these are all wrapped up into one, but you're not staying in your lane in a sense. Like, what compelled you to jump into this?
I was just going to say that's at least two questions.
Yeah.
But the why did I attend the meeting?
Yeah.
Because of creativity, helping others, and personal growth. Yeah. You know, like a chance to hear the needs and feelings, especially at this time of disconnection, of colleagues in small nonprofits. And then also, hey, I might learn something that could help me do my job and accomplish my personal mission in a way that's better and stronger. So I better say yes and see what this is all about. Mm-hmm. The Imagine MKE, when y'all arrived, like Minerva fully formed from the head of Zeus, I was totally skeptical. And I think partly because I have a love of grassroots and organic growth. So like a need and small growth stemming and then growing slowly over time and then fulfilling a necessity in the community. And so I thought, okay, here's this capitalized organization with a staff, but they haven't done anything yet. So like, what's that all about? Mm-hmm. And I remember like being charged by the mission and thinking, okay, I understand what the words connection and amplify mean, mm-hmm. but what do they mean here? Like, what, What do you do? Do they make art? What do they do? And so it was really like there were vivid turning points here. Like the Artist Relief Fund, you had me at the Artist Relief Fund. Like the second that I found out about it, I was like 100% on board, you know, because it's just so personally near and dear to my heart to like get resources directly into the hands of artists. And the way that you structured the relief fund also was just, it was impressive and open, and I thought that was terrific. And then the meetings forged meaningful connection and felt useful. And then also the amplification of the message that we're dead last in state funding for the arts, to like not turn it again. But I feel like I've been, we were 48th for a long time, and I was like yelling that into the void for years. And I would just kind of walk around from meeting to meeting wondering why we're not talking about this all the time everywhere. Like,
you're gonna make a sandwich board?
And it's actually gotten worse, you know? Like, we were 48th.
Well, they brought in American Samoa and Guam, which really messed up. They were like, jacked us down even more. Yeah, right. So
we have this recurring bit in our staff meetings about sandwich boards. So Joanna, like, do you want the sandwich board? Because we can make one for you, and sure, we'll join you in the streets.
I'll do it, just because it's just kind of absurd that we don't care more about it.
Yeah.
I also feel like it's our responsibility to make it important. Like, if we can do fabulous work, then support. People will want to support it, right? Or is that just too optimistic?
Yeah, I think I can hold both skepticism and optimism at the same time. I want to note that this group of small arts and culture has been convening since about April or so in different ways. And it's been a pretty consistent group, 11 to 20 folks. I was wondering, are these folks that you've already kind of connected with prior to, you know, like, Could you let me know about that? Like, how much of that was new to you, or how much of that was like one-offs? Could you just sort of tell me about, you know, sort of the arrangement, if you will, of being able to be in an affinity?
Yeah. So I think that very first meeting was maybe like, was it like 19 or 20 some people? Yep. And maybe 8 or 9 were colleagues I had worked with or collaborated on a project with, mostly in theater, arts, dance, or music. Right. And then it was like others that I had heard of, familiar with their work, but doing poetry or book arts or spoken word, but hadn't collaborated with, never worked with. And that was interesting. And also people whose names I've known on paper, but it was like different to see their faces and like be in a meeting together. So it was, maybe I knew about half of the people, but I do remember, I think it might've been Mac who said somewhere in that meeting, like, y'all are under the radar for each other. Like that even in the small arts ecosystem, we weren't even aware of each other's work and presence in a comprehensive way. Cause we are like, we're working so hard to till the soil in our little garden.
Yeah. I think there's just, my mental model is that by nature, arts and culture is already very segregated, siloed, or something by practice.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or even by sub specialty of practice, or even by geography, right? Like I might address this specific part of the town, if you will, and definitely a city like Milwaukee, geography is huge in terms of that, right? And the history of segregation, the history of all that. So to your point, like it's hard enough to survive, much less to be thinking, what do I have in common with this drum circle or this culinary arts, right? So, but the hypothesis was, well, what if there was a space for these folks to come together and find affinity or find ways, you know, how might the learning happen and how might that be?
We had put together a committee meeting of the leaders of all of our standing work groups. And it was fascinating to see Annie Peterson on our team put together this incredible map of all the people who had sort of participated in the construction of Minerva, as it were, right? In the creation of Imagine MKE. It was fascinating to see one of our board members sort of review the list of folks who had participated. And he said, he pointed out a small theater company and he was like, God, I don't even know these folks. And I think that suggested to us that like, it was sort of a moment for me to sort of rethink my assumption as the outsider coming in that like all of you know each other and work together and sort of have a sense of affinity and a sense of togetherness that just isn't there, right? And I think one of the things on our to-do list is how do we increase those that to your point, that sense of connection, that we can actually be a sector with really shared goals, right? That what's good for a Milwaukee Opera Theater is good for any other performing arts or arts organization in general.
So, Jillianna, you were referring earlier this thread of continuous learning, right, and continued growth. And for me, that translates into leadership, right? In the sense that if this is something I hold, if I want external things to change,
sure,
right, I am probably contributing them in some way, the way I'm leading, right? So if I can interrogate and examine how I lead or how I do, and perhaps adapt that behavior, that will probably have an effect, right, in the outside. So what it is that, like, in order for, if I don't like status quo, there is something about me that I need to adapt and adjust. Right. Sure. Right. And so it sounds like you have an affinity with that, right? This notion of that. And that's really hard to do, I think, right? When you're doing all these other things, you're spinning all these plates, you know, to create space and time for yourself to do that. But I will hold here and imagine, like, one of the things that I think that if we want things to generally change, right, to be better for not just arts and culture, but for all of Milwaukee, right? There needs to be a way for our leaders, grass tops, grassroots, in role, not in role, to come together and both align, but also learn, right? And so that's been the work of this Small Arts and Culture Group. There's a driving thing of sustainability. Given COVID-19 has disrupted the ways that small arts and culture can do its practice, but also sustain itself, right? What a great excuse for us to come together to think, what will we do different now, right? And so there's a doing element, but I believe, right, Jillette, that unless we infuse that space with introducing other ways of looking at it, you might be prone to kind of doing the same thing over and over again, right? If you didn't have an opportunity to shift that. And so I wanted to let our listeners know, in addition to having you all convene to think about, well, how do we look at sustainability differently? We've also had introduce other concepts, right? So in a sense, yeah. Right, I come from leadership development. We've sort of experimented. What if this group is like a leadership cohort? Like, they didn't sign up for a leadership school, but we're going to assume that they want to learn, right? And so what we shared with y'all was this article called Ideas, Arrangements, Effects. And just to summarize, and we'll link to it in the description, but this notion of these social design for Design Studio for Social Intervention just put out this book. And their proposal is this notion of there are big ideas that drive our arrangements, and these arrangements have real effects on us. And that can get really overwhelming. In a sense that, like, racism is an idea, arrangements are born out of these ideas, and ultimately we feel the effects. And the reason why it matters to look at this framework is sometimes we're attacking just the effects when really we need to look at the arrangements, right? And so I sort of thought, what a great opportunity for small arts and culture leaders to look at sustainability as rather addressing the effects, but what might be the arrangements. And so that's the other dimension of this conversation would love to explore with you. And that's really why I brought you here, is because I was really struck by how you've modeled how you're leading, you know, MOT as well as your peers, but you're also learning in real time about this. And I'm really interested in picking your brain about small arts and culture in Milwaukee, right? And what are the ideas, arrangements, effects? So hopefully I gave enough of a primer for our listeners.
You did. Okay, oh, you sure
talking,
did.
We're talking
well,
about.
Thanks for mentioning that you'd been like slipping leadership into the coffee you were giving us.
Yeah.
So I know that I talked at one of those meetings about how because the stakes are different and they tend to be smaller and more manageable at the small organizations, they are more easily innovative. Mm-hmm. And so some of the progress that, like, we wish we could see in our community is happening faster in the small organizations than in many of the larger organizations because of our nimbleness and flexibility. One thing I read that article carefully. I might've even read it more than once. I had already kind of drank that Kool-Aid about arrangements, like something about shifting away from singing and classical music into theater. I was like attuned to the environment moving to this city I hadn't been in a very long time in 2009. It was also 2009, so a lot was happening.
Yep.
The arts that summer in Milwaukee, and I was just really learning, kind of coming with a blank slate and learning, okay, what are these structures of these companies and what's happening in the performing arts and how is the recession affecting it and what are the challenges? And I remember, like, in that summer, I think I saw a one woman show at a big company and I was just like staring at the program. It was great. I mean, it was a great piece, very beautifully done. But I was like, there's one artist on stage, like the actor, there's one actor. And then there's like this gigantic staff and this huge building. And we're just all watching one actor, you know? And I remember thinking, I wonder what would happen, like if you flipped that pyramid, right? So like, what if instead of like having really investing in infrastructure and administrative power, you spent most of your resources on artists and then just tried to really ask, like, part of it is that time in the world changes, but we keep measuring things the same way we always have, or we just keep doing them the same way we have. Yeah. So like it was 2009 and I thought, could we get all the legal and administrative work of an opera company done from a laptop in a coffee shop? Like, can you do that now? Yeah. Because do you need an office? Like, can you just get the paper files you have to have like in a little plastic box that you could carry around if you have to? You know, do you need to have a phone line? Because there are cell phones now. Yeah. So like, I have a cell phone. I could just use that. We could save that money. And so like it began as kind of this wild experiment to see if it is possible to flip that paradigm.
Yeah.
And we've kind of just been tinkering with it since. So it's like right off the bat, we started doing like kind of like we did a piece with DanceWorks in the Linden Sculpture Garden years ago that had 75 performers and no stage manager. Like, because we were just kind of toying with the model. Like, we're always asking, stage managers are amazing and they're vital to many performances, but do you need one at every single kind of performance always?
Yeah.
Maybe not, you know? Like, we just tried a system of checking in with the performers and we kind of sort of crossed our fingers and hoped that people were where they needed to be.
Yeah.
But we've also done things with a cast of 45 and it's like, I was the only full-time administrator, you know, and we had to do them differently. We didn't run those shows for 32 performances over 4 weeks, but we did them. And it was kind of a way of playing with that and asking, is this the only way? Because I think a lot of times those costs of the infrastructure are fixed and they keep going up year after year because they're hit by inflation. And the only line that can wiggle is the artist on stage. Like, you can just always do a smaller show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you still have to pay your rent, but you can always do a smaller show. And it was like, pretty soon we're going to do like an a cappella show in the dark with one person singing, you know, like they'll have just like cut everything else out of the budget. So I think I've been toying with arrangements for 10 years in those different ways. And the conversations were inspiring because some people I had worked with as a close cohort already, but then you also hear from others who are doing somewhat different work and maybe have a totally different funding model, you know, or totally different expectations about who they serve and where the money comes from. Mm. And so then you think like, like, is there a way to borrow some of that, or would that be better to just kind of actively question assumptions all the time instead of just repeating behavior because we're familiar with it? I think that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, Jill, that you mentioned those simple innovations, even in 2009 of like, do I need a phone? Do I need a landline? Do I need all this bricks and mortar, right? To hold these elements, right?
Well, part of it is also like definitions of success.
Right. That's what I was getting to.
If we have an office, we're a 50 and it means we're good at this.
That's right.
So it's like, can we dare ourselves to not have anything?
And right.
Just critiquing our work.
But I think it's fascinating that there are some industries where those things would be hailed as like incredible, like you are on the cutting edge. Like we need to throw more money at you because you're super creative, as opposed to like, I don't know if I trust this place. Right. So I think it's interesting, right? Like, what is it about this industry, using quote air quotes, that it, and I think it goes back to, and we're going to dive into this notion of what are the mindsets that have been lifted up or frames that we want to interrogate. One that's come up is this notion of small equals inferior, right? Yeah. That's, you're right. Or the small means like, you know, on some level, it's like, do you have the playbill that has all the companies that are listed in it, that has all the names and all the ads? There's some element of like heft here, right? And so it almost is like, I trust this more possibly. As opposed to, like you said, wow, I'm watching a 75-person show in a sculpture garden that it almost feels ethereal, right? It's going to be gone in a moment. I would argue that is an amazing achievement, right? Of an organization, self-organization, flash mobbiness, whatever you call it. It was a force to get that going. Why isn't that currency held up? I'm like, wow, what is the technology and brain power that is to do that? Right? Like, it's interesting how it's not seen as such. And so I think that's something that has been lifted up. I don't know if you wanted to react to that or other mindsets for you that you've been over the last couple months that you've been invited to toy more with, or in the face of sustainability, right? In the face of knowing the status quo is not acceptable.
Well, I mean, you just reminded me, like for many years, speaking of programs, I think like we look for, because we feel undervalued, and I speak for actually every artist at every level, like it actually doesn't matter whether you're, you know, at one of the biggest companies in the country or one of the smallest, you still have this feeling of like, why can't I just connect with everybody? Why can't this message reach everybody? Mm-hmm. But I think we look for markers of success, and those traditional markers can kind of lead us wayward or away from some of our values, I think. So like for many, many years, we had a one-page black and white program at MOT. It was like a trifold program that I did myself on my computer. And because that was part of like, we're going to funnel as many of the resources as we can into the hands of the artists. And if that means like not having a glossy 8-page program, that's what it means. And so we started like, we'll put their bios on the website because that's free. And then we'll keep the program really small. And then we'll have another $200 to put toward, you know, snacks or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, so there's one audience that would look at that and might go, gosh, this is a fly by night.
Yeah.
But there might be some audience that goes like, man, this is punk, right? This is legit. This is, they are, you know,
it almost feels like there's like, it's like a proxy for quality, right? Like, I think there might be, and I don't know, but it feels like there might be a sense that people just don't know what's good. So when you have sort of the external signifiers of what's good, right? Yeah. Like you have the office, you have the address, you have the 8-page program that is sort of gets you in the door of saying, whatever I'm going to is worthwhile, right? As opposed to, I think, this other frame, which is like that potentially not having those things also suggests a certain quality, or a quality as good as the folks who have all this other stuff. But it's just not as in a world where nobody knows what is better than anything else, right? I mean, it just, and I think that is part of what's so exciting about what this group is doing, right? Like how do the Small Arts and Culture group, like how do we as in you, the royal us, come up with a framework for understanding that, like, when you don't see those exterior signifiers of success or whatever it might be, that, you know, you are getting similar, if not better, at least different work.
Yeah, very
also worthwhile.
Yeah, very different. I mean, I remember like I brought up a restaurant analogy of like, or I read a lot of books about restaurants. Mm-hmm. For some reason, that seems like a metaphor that I'm kind of always applying to performing arts, because there's so many similarities and crossovers. But like in the slow food movement and just the restaurant culture, like there's a much stronger sense of experimentation and seeking new experiences. And I do think in the performing arts, sometimes we get wedged into this like, well, I have to know it's going to be great before I shell out $20. You know, and I think like if we try a restaurant and we don't like it, we don't say like, well, I don't like food anymore. you just don't go back to that restaurant. Like, but I think sometimes for the performing arts, it's like, or especially opera, it's like, oh man, I went to one once, hated it. You know, and you're like, well, that was okay. But there's all this other stuff.
Right. Is that, I think that's a mantra in our office as well, because we're interfacing with all these different forms. And just because it's not for me, right? It might be lovely and great. It just might not be for me. And that's not right. It's not to be like, oh man, I hate that. It's just like, it's good at what it is, or maybe on its own merits, it works. And sure. Okay, great. I'll know not to go to that one next time, but at least I can say like, oh, they're trying to do what they're trying to do.
It is functionally different. Like, it's not, small organizations aren't like less successful versions of large organizations.
Right. That's right.
Like,
right.
Maybe sometimes it gets kind of confused in theater because they may actually program the same production or something like that. But from the get-go, you're receiving a different experience, you know, at every level. So among the small arts organizations, like a lot of the people on those Zoom calls are founders, or it's the artistic director. Like at a small company, it might be the artistic director selling you the ticket at the box office when you come, you know, and they're just right there. And the people in it are very likely to live and work here. And they're teachers at your kid's school, or they might be your next door neighbor. They're professional artists, but they're like living and working in the community in which we live, and not someone who flew in from a different city for 3 weeks, which is also wonderful and a need, but like not the only thing. Like, yeah. I think it's an and equation.
Yeah.
And it's just a very different experience to sit, as you know, David, to sit in a 45 seat house or a 99 seat house compared to a 2000 seat house. You have a different feeling as an audience member when you're part of a smaller group. And then one of the things that I think is the coolest about small arts and culture, maybe this is like my sort of obsession with witnessing artistic growth, but like you get to see the same people in different roles many times over the course of years. So like, I even remember I spent my adulthood, early adulthood in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
But like falling in love with regional companies and the ability to like, I've been watching this guy for 9 years, you know, and I've seen him do 27 different things, and it's so incredible and fulfilling. It's a very different experience than like seeing people you don't know once
and
then they go away and never come back.
Yeah.
You know, so the attachment is different.
Yeah.
That was the moment, actually, for me as a young person in New York City, seeing these incredible actors grind off Broadway and in small theaters, where I was like, I'm not half as good as them. And if they're not making it, there's no way I'm going to make it.
Once you come to that reckoning, then you're like, and arts admins for me, I guess, right? Or like, that's the world, right? Because you got to have that almost like, I had the same journey myself, right? As an improviser, right? It's like, you know, I thought, man, if I'm not, you know, those guys aren't getting cast, what do I got? And if that moment, like once I lost that, then I'm like, you got to have that eye of the tiger, almost that delusional sense of like, I'm going to get there.
Yeah, right? I definitely remember thinking New York does not need me. And I also remember thinking, like, when we did move to Milwaukee, like looking around and going, well, no one's paying attention, so we could do whatever we want.
We could do whatever we want. Yeah.
Like, there is something that's actually beautiful and generative about being in flyover country.
Yeah.
So, it's like, we can actually be riotously experimental.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, no one's watching, so we can just like do it and see if it works.
So we usually ask our guests, you know, to be, we do this bit called the Arts and Culture Czar, where we ask them, oh, what laws would you pass, right? And because we're kind of building off this different conversation, I want to hold on to that spirit, right? But I'm going to ask it in a different way. And going back to arrangements, right? In arts and culture in Milwaukee, what are new arrangements that you would like to see happen, right? Which, you know, in fairness, those arrangements would probably be accelerated by policy changes. But I'm really interested from your perspective, what are the arrangements you would like to see in service to a vibrant Milwaukee? Because its arts and culture ecosystem also has that vibrancy. Well, what would be your response to that?
I think centrally that arts and culture are necessary for our souls, and artists are vital to the functioning city. That, like, I mean, that's where I center the work less on, like, oh, we should study music because it'll improve test scores in math, or you should support the opera company because they also hire printers and caterers and you pay for parking and it boosts the economic imprint in the area, both of which are true, but they feel secondary or tertiary compared to you are fulfilling an immediate need in helping us adjust to being humans, right? Like, it's like lifelong, what the heck is this and what does it all mean? right, you like go right to the question, and we need that, like we need air and water. Like, whether we think we need it or not, we do. And so I would like to see artists treated as actually just valuable. And I don't mean just money. I mean treated as valuable, like acknowledged as necessary and healthy for the environment. And organizations that support artists, I would love to see them actually treat artists like they're valuable and necessary. Because sometimes it's this sort of like prove it situation that we get into instead of we believe in you and we're happy to support this because we know that what you do is important.
What sort of lands for me is this, you know, we have been trying to play or trying to tell both sides of that story, right? On the one side, I think you're right that like the soul of a city is about its creatives, right? And how do we like ensure that our city's artists and creatives feel valued, have the supports they need to be able to work and rehearse and sell and show and all that stuff? And that is the sanctity of our city's creative soul, I think, is sort of bound up in that, right? And I think that's super important. That's got to be sort of front and center. And then on the other hand, you know, a lot of the folks in our stakeholder group are always asking us to tell the story of the economic impact of the arts. And, you know, I agree, I join them in that it is important, but I also sort of, my view is a little bit more nuanced, right? In that, like, if our policymakers were going to be moved by that for this issue, they would have been moved already.
This would have happened a long time ago.
It would have happened already, right?
It's not really about economics.
Right. So we have enough research. We have enough facts. We have enough all of that stuff, right? So it almost feels like, yeah, we have to sort of put that out there, but then also double back to this, to the other point that you have, right? We have to sort of like touch the argument or the storytelling with the essentialness of the arts, because if we don't do it, I don't know who else, right? If the arts community doesn't do it, I don't know who else is going to do it. And that story, I think, oftentimes will get lost under the sort of instrumental argument of the arts in the city, which is the economic impact and so on and so forth.
Jill, can you give me those three things that drive you again? Those three elements that you were just sharing. Just share, because I want to share. What were those three things again?
Creativity,
right?
Personal growth and helping others.
So I'll say that when you said that really resonated with me, because there's this notion of like, I think that's what artists are doing in the sense of they're seeing stuff that hasn't been seen before, right? And putting it in a form that may not have been even thought of before, but when we look at it, the strange become familiar, the familiar becomes strange.
Yeah, right. Right.
And then we get to engage and we're human, right? Okay, so, right, this is kind of getting into crystals and woo stuff. So I'm being very conscious of that, right? But that is such a huge, like that in itself is so powerful, right? And here's my wondering, my first draft thinking, take the best, leave the rest, right? But when we say artists, capital A, they're almost like these magical unicorns, like they're the only ones. When reality, like everybody, right? Everybody has to do that to be a great parent, because you're solving lots of problems you never experienced before, to be a great, you know, whatever employee field you are, you're probably taking on issues, right? That has never been seen before, right? And you got to be creative to do that, right? So an element somehow we've made, or I don't know if it's we, but there's this notion of like artistry is separate. Like there's these magical unicorns that can only do art. But if the thought was that everybody actually does art in some way, there's an artistry in everyone, right? Then it becomes like air, like you're talking about. Because, well, gosh, if not everybody gets to be an artist, how can they be a great baker? How can they be a great school teacher? How can they be a great middle manager that renegotiates mortgages for people, right? Like even though the like insurance sales probably isn't the most like compelling thing to me, there's an art there, right? There's an art of the sale. There's an art of the like finding the right thing, or talk to a paralegal. There is an art to what they do, right? And I just sort of wonder, right? Like, gosh, how did we disconnect that only certain folks, and again, it's not blaming you or anybody, but I think collectively we put in this box, because again, we could argue that the economic difference, like there are implications for health and economics. This is me on my soapbox to all of our 100 listeners who already get it. But there's something about how does that change? Because I think by making it about magical unicorns, then it's this thing of the wealthy, right? It's this optional nice to have, as opposed to what you're saying. No, this is the stuff that makes sure that our water isn't toxic and that.
Right.
You know, I think.
It helps us focus. It lowers our stress. It makes us feel connected to others. Like, it's all good. There's kind of like no bad side.
I've often said that we're sort of reflecting back to to one of your earlier points, Juliana, about Imagine MKE. When I joined, I was very clear that we were going to be an arts organization that doesn't actually do art, right? That doesn't actually make anything except meetings, right? That would be our sort of form of practice. And we were very intentional to go out to get Mac to help us lead our meetings and help us implement our meeting structure and how we convene. And part of that was in recognition that if people were to engage with us, the thing that they saw had to be excellent. And I am hoping, and some of the feedback that we've already gotten about Mac has been that, you know, he does meetings unlike any others. I think to underscore his point though, right, like the sense of artistry, if you sort of in creativity, right, if you engage your daily work in that way, if we can sort of share that broadly, it's something that enriches the city far beyond just what's happening in a gallery or a performing arts space or anywhere else that you would go see art, right? We can actually sort of engage with it in our daily lives.
Yeah. I think one of the first things I thought within like 5 minutes of meeting number one was like, I'm going to learn more about meetings from Mac. And I didn't think I needed more meetings in my life. No, that's pretty sure.
You just need more of the right meetings in your life. Jill, as we wind down our conversation with you, you know, recognizing 2020 has really sucked ass. That's a technical term. A lot of times we try to look at joy and abundance as much as we can. And so we're inviting you to share this. What makes you hopeful? This could be either in your personal life or in your role as an arts and culture leader at MOT or beyond. What makes you hopeful? And can you just share a quick story, one example where hope is ignited for you?
Sure. I'm hopeful about the conversations that we've been having about all of these things, all of the conversations. I'm going to turn it right back to cynicism and say that my fear is that nothing will change.
Yeah.
Right. That we're going through this moment of suspension, which is like the world couldn't give us a better opportunity to rearrange some things. Right. And my fear is that we'll spend our time trying to preserve the status quo so that we can just get right back to it when things clear. And so I hope that we can actually like live through the conversations and make some meaningful changes in the way that we work, in the way that we shepherd power and resources through the community.
Stellar. Well, thanks for taking the time to visit with us outside of the many hats that you wear. And thanks for your continued leadership in it. And I'm hopeful of a new arrangement where small arts and culture gets to be vibrant and thrive. And we even foster more artists in Milwaukee and increase the audiences to take them in and celebrate them. Thanks so much for your leadership, Jill.
Well, thanks for everything you do, Matt.
Wow, that went by so fast. Even though when I looked at the clock, you're like, we've been on this for almost like an hour. But that's fun.
Longest episode ever, I think. We're going to have to go back in the archives to figure it out. But you're right. It went by like a flash.
Well, for me, it did. I don't want to speak for our listener. But
I'll speak for our listeners. It went by like a flash.
Good. Good. I'm glad you did. One of us had to do that. I think what resonates for me, you know, why it reaffirmed why I'm excited that we use this podcast to highlight not just our leaders in role, right, who are doing really important work administering, right, organizations so that art can be created and artists can be supported to do the work, et cetera, right? But it was just really fascinating to have an opportunity to hear Jill Anna talk about just her mindsets and just sort of how she continues to learn on the job and work on the job. And I think that's what I'm excited about talking about on this pod, right? What are the viewpoints people are holding and how does it inform how they do and how are you interrogating them and challenging yourself to move beyond them? Because ultimately the current situation is a result of how we're practicing the current mindsets we have. And so if we want a different result, we got to be ready to try different mindsets and hopefully do different behaviors because of it.
Yeah, I really appreciated how clear she was with how she shows up to her work, the sort of three-prong approach of maximizing her creativity, maximizing her own personal growth, and then maximizing her ability to help others through her practice at Milwaukee Opera Theater. And obviously, I think also in how she shows up in the sector with others. I thought it was just really generous and graceful and inspiring. And so, you know, we've often talked about how we grow a leaderful system, right? And I think that sort of ethos is something that we ought to be promoting. More and more, hopefully more and more folks will engage with us and with the work with that kind of generosity and grace.
And I'm delighted to share there's a lot more Jill Annas in our network. And I'm excited to get to know more of them and using this platform to amplify their stories and their leadership as well. So thanks again, Jill Anna, and thanks in advance to those who will be bringing on the pod. And we're thankful for you, listener, for listening to yet another edition, episode 31, I believe. Wow. Where has the time gone? Again, where has the time gone?
God, we're closer to 52 than we are to one. I mean, it's we are...
We're closer to the butt of this loaf than we are to the head of this loaf. David, we want to remind the folks, rate it 5 stars, share a positive review, share it out. We want more folks to find us and hear about leaders like Jill Anna and the artists, champions we have in Milwaukee. You can also email us at pod@imagine.org if you've got recommendations on who we should be talking to or stories about how you're making connections with the leaders that we're bringing on the pod.
Let us know if you are a head of the loaf person or a butt of the loaf person or just regular slices on social at Twitter or on Instagram at @imagine_MKE or on Facebook at @imagine_MKE. Mention the pod on the social and your bread preference and we will make you a #imaginaryfriend. Make sure you take action on writing your elected officials about the important legislation they have to pass in these next few weeks to ensure that there is federal funding to support arts and culture through the COVID-19 response. And make sure you tune into our sister and brother podcast, Arts Forward MKE, hosted by Lindsay Sheridan, and Black Imagination, hosted by Kanita and Antoine.
Until then, we look forward to hearing about your bread preferences or perhaps even a tortilla.